Okay, let's get started. This is Jason from Strength Running, and I'm really excited. Today I'm talking to Matt Fitzgerald, who likely needs no introduction, but he is the author of, I believe, over 15 books on running, triathlon, and sports nutrition, including two of my favorites, Brain Training and Racing Weight. And his latest book is called Diet Cults, The Surprising Fallacy at the Core of Nutrition Fads, and a guide to healthy eating for the rest of us. Matt, thanks so much for talking today.
Great to be with you.
All right. So this is the book I wished I could have written, but I'm just simply not qualified enough to do so. For years, I've kind of always thought that the ideal way that distance runners should eat for their best performance is just to eat the healthiest version of every food, you know, including meat and carbohydrate and fruit and every other food group. You know, I think as nature's ultimate omnivore, you say our ideal diet is what you call agnostic healthy eating. And I really love this term. Can you tell us a little bit more about it and what exactly it means?
Yes. So agnostic healthy eating really just means a culturally normal diet for whatever culture you happen to belong to, but with the highest quality standards, within that framework. So if you're an American, you know, you may have, you know, a bagel for breakfast, soup and salad for lunch, those types of things that are familiar foods, but just, you know, you're having whole grain bread versus Wonder Bread. You know, your soup is a vegetable soup versus, you know, some, I don't know, clam chowder. So that's all it is. And that is what, you know, one of the cool things I get to do in my work is study the diets of the world's best endurance athletes, and very, very few of them, whether it's an Ethiopian runner or a British cyclist or an American runner, very few of them are follow what I call diet cults. The vast majority just eat that really high quality, culturally normal diet.
And so this is a cultural diet. It's not necessarily a diet with a name. I think that's an important distinction for us to make.
Right. Exactly that. If your diet, of course, I've just given a name to this. It's now agnostic healthy eating, but that doesn't mean it's also a diet cult, and I'm guilty of hypocrisy. Because I'm really what makes a diet cult is the claim that that particular rule bound way of eating is the only healthy way to eat, or that it is, you know, by far the healthiest way to eat. I'm not really making that claim for my rules of agnostic healthy eating. I'm just saying that it's a broad and flexible framework that is pretty easy for anyone to work within. So, you know, you could conceivably break one or more of the rules of agnostic healthy eating, and, you know, if you do it carefully, come out okay. You know, I'm not claiming that, you know, I have identified a diet that's better than all the diet cults. It's just, I think it's the easiest way to eat healthy.
That's a good point. So let's talk for a second about vegetarian or vegan athletes, because I think this is an interesting case study. And I have several friends who are plant-based athletes, runners, even ultra-marathoners. And so years ago, when I went through the USA Track and Field coaching curriculum, there was a very brief discussion about diet during the lessons on endurance training. And the instructor was pretty adamant that distance runners have to eat meat and certainly need to eat a lot of carbohydrate in addition to that. And I actually went back into my notes and pulled, some of the quotes that he was saying. And, you know, he was saying he's never met a world-class female distance runner who's a vegetarian or a vegan. And he's actually seen countless female athletes improve their performance when they start to eat meat. Now, aside from the, you know, obvious ethical reasons not to eat animal products if you happen to have them, which isn't really what I kind of want to get into today, what's your view on plant-based diets for serious distance runners? Can you be plant-based and still perform at your peak?
You can. Take the East African runners. Those are poor countries, Ethiopia and Kenya, and most people can't afford to eat very much meat. And they don't. Once runners achieve a certain level of success, that they can afford more and may eat more. But most of the animal proteins that they get are from dairy, actually. And it's like a flexitarian type of diet, and they're the best runners in the world, so it works out okay for them. I mean, they're not vegetarians in any strict sense or even by choice, but it is a very low meat diet, and it works out just great for them. I think the reason there may be very few vegetarian world-class female runners outside of those countries is that often female runners especially will restrict their diet for the wrong reasons and end up harming themselves because they're just simply not eating enough. You know, they tend to, you know, there's this double standard where male athletes eat for performance and female athletes eat for performance and the mirror, you know, and so you get that adds a complexity. So a lot of women will remove something from their diet, and really it's not the absence of the something in particular, it's that they're simply just not getting enough nutrition to fuel the hard training they're doing. So not necessarily a meat specific thing, but I mean, often it will result, if it is meat, that's restricted in iron deficiency anemia or something like that. So, you know, the long and short of it is that if you do it right, I think you can run, perform at the highest level as a vegetarian. But it's not the place I would start. I would say eat meat unless you really have a compelling reason, maybe the ethical thing, not to.
Do you think it's a little bit more difficult? I know you were saying if you want to be a plant-based athlete, you can do that. You just have to eat correctly. Is eating correctly as a plant-based athlete, in addition to being an endurance athlete, is that more difficult? And I guess one of the reasons why I ask is I've seen the food log of Scott Jurek, and it's quite impressive. When he's in peak training, he's eating something like 7,000 or 8,000 calories a day, and his grocery bill is $600 a week. I mean, if you're a plant-based athlete, do you have to go to that kind of extreme?
It is more difficult, but by definition. You know, in Diet Cults, I have a chapter about Lewis and Clark and what they ate on their transcontinental journey. And except in certain periods of deprivation, it was a heavily carnivorous diet. Why? Because when you're out in the middle of nowhere, killing and eating animals is by far the most efficient way to get a lot of calories. And these guys were basically endurance athletes. They were on the move. So, you know, we're not in exactly those circumstances, but the principle still applies, that eating meat is a very efficient way to get, you know, the protein and the overall calories that you need to handle a high training load. So if you voluntarily eliminate that from your diet, yes, it does make it more difficult.
And I think too, the point that you mentioned earlier about eating the best quality food sources is really important here too. I know that there are some very poor types of meat that you can eat in today's, particularly in the United States. And I think that's just an important note to make here.
Yes, I totally agree. You know, most of the meat that we eat is bad. If you look at epidemiological studies on the health effects of eating meat, they're bad. but you know, I don't think that's because meat in general is something we shouldn't eat. It's that most of the meat in the American diet today is of low quality. What I generally recommend, if you're going to break down that category of foods, is that you eat more fish than poultry, more poultry than unprocessed red meat, and more unprocessed red meat than processed red meat. That's kind of a good way to weight the food types within that general category.
I like how simple that is. Okay, so let's move on a little bit. One of the themes that runs through Diet Cults is that you think society has made eating overly complex. There are too many specific diets, superfoods, weight loss cures, and all that stuff, and it can paralyze us. It's easier to keep eating our typical standard American diet rather than improving on it. Why is it so hard for us to choose healthy food? Don't we already know what clean foods are and what is unhealthy in today's food landscape?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is that people who really don't know much about nutrition, when they decide to improve their diet, they usually make smart choices. In the book, I give a couple examples from the world of endurance sports. Chris Zelinski was one, you know, the former American record holder at 10,000 meters. And Chris Horner, the cyclist, is another. These guys, they just, especially Chris Horner, the cyclist, he had an atrociously bad diet, which tells you he doesn't really know a lot about nutrition. But when he decided to improve it, he did, you know, common sense stuff. He drank less soft drinks. He ate less fast food. He ate more vegetables. And guess what? The dude lost close to 10 pounds and took his cycling to another level.
And I'm sure he wasn't 10 pounds overweight either.
Right, exactly. I mean, if you're looking in the mirror, you wouldn't have known there was an ounce of excess. But then you take people who do, you know, the people who, unlike a Chris Horner, actually do read diet books and, you know, nutrition articles and popular magazines. Those are the ones who, when they change their diet, are likely to get seduced into doing something that's complex, just, you know, too clever by half. So it goes to show you that knowledge is really not the problem. It's too much information. You know, we're in a situation where creating new diets is an industry. And if you're going to keep coming up with something new, almost by definition, you have to get more complex, right? You know, because the simple stuff has already been done. And that's where all the noise comes from and the confusion for people who, you know, allow themselves to lose the forest for the trees. So I say, you know, just put yourself in the mindset of a third grader. what does a third grader know about nutrition? You know, soft drinks bad, broccoli good. You know, you don't really need to go any further than that.
I love that simplicity. Because you mentioned the industry of these diets. Do you think this is, are we doomed to hear about 47 new diets every year? Or do you think we're on a path to kind of making things simple again?
Well, I do see this. I think that just based in part on the response to my book and the agnostic healthy eating concept, I think there is a diet fatigue setting in that more and more people will be ready to embrace. But at the same time, I think, you know, the trend of coming up with new diets and people allowing themselves to, you know, fall for magic bullets, I don't see that trend going away anytime soon. So I'm just focused on, you know, doing my part to, you know, get more and more people to join the movement, as it were.
Yeah, to try to simplify the entire diet arena out there.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I really try to teach the runners that I coach and, you know, the readers who read my stuff is that good running principles, training principles are universal. And I hear from many runners who ask, you know, if accepted proven principles of injury prevention and training progression will work for them because they're older or they're a trail runner or they're a Midwestern mom of three, you know, whatever it happens to be. And of course the answer is yes. You know, mileage works, you know, sound injury prevention practices work. It doesn't really matter who you are. And one of the things that I'm really interested in when it comes to diet cults is the notion of universal diet truths. Are there these universal truths similar to training truths, or are there just far too many nuances?
I think that the parallel is perfect because we're all the same species of animal, right? So when it comes to endurance training, what works for one person works for all people. As a general framework, as you well know, there are individual differences. So when you get to the level of details and specifics, you may find someone who, you know, adapts to high intensity training very quickly. You may find another who has a much lower tolerance for high intensity training. And so you start off with the same place with everyone, but after they get past a certain point of progress and you want to take them further, that's where you start to individualize a little bit. The same is very much true of diet. I think the framework of agnostic healthy eating is one that every person should operate within if they want to maximize their health. However, you know, it's well understood that there are individual differences. You can take something obvious like, lactose intolerance. You know, some people just, they can't do non-fermented dairy. So be it. I can, and I'm thankful for that. But I think that parallel you're drawing between training and diet is perfect.
Okay, good. I'm kind of glad you said that. I was worried if you were to say something different, I wouldn't have any response.
We're on the same page.
So one of the chapters in your book that I want to touch on really quickly is the chapter that you have on the potato. I think the potato in a lot of diet cults, and I think in just kind of popular culture, has been vilified. And you really go into this and talk a little bit more about it. Can you use this as an example of some of the themes in your book and kind of exact what's going on with the potato in our culture?
Yeah, so I wanted to include a chapter in the book that focused on a specific food that was unfairly demonized. And I could have chosen others. I could have chosen eggs or wheat or milk, but I chose the potato. The potato, it's funny, if you go back before the era of nutrition science, when people didn't know what foods were made of, the way we judged a food was that we ate it, and then we saw how we felt, and if we felt good, we decided it was a good food. And that was how the potato was judged from the time it was first discovered about 14, 15,000 years ago until the dawn of the era of nutrition science. And arguably, the potato has done more to enhance human health than any other food. It's one of the few foods that people can survive on as basically their sole source of energy. There've been some interesting, at one point in Ireland, one third of Irish in the 19th century lived on an all potato diet, and far from harming their health, it actually slashed mortality rates so that there was a population explosion in Ireland. So it wasn't hurting them. Then you had a couple individual researchers in the 19th century who went on all potato diets for, one of them went on one for more than a year, supplemented with a little bit of milk and butter. And the results were fantastic. And even more recently, when the government threatened to remove potatoes from school lunches, which is just, I don't understand, because most of the potatoes we eat are fried. That's part of the reason I think they get a bad reputation. But anyway, so there was a guy who, to protest that, went on an all potato diet for 60 days. He lost weight, and his triglyceride and total cholesterol and fasting glucose levels all improved significantly over that 2 month period. So it's a supremely—
it sounds like a Morgan Spurlock experiment.
Right, exactly. So it's a supremely healthy food. The reason it got a bad reputation is, again, we just got too clever. We came up with this glycemic index, and we decided that any food that resulted in a spike in the blood glucose level, followed by a spike in insulin, had to be bad. So we were judging foods no longer by their ultimate health effects, but by this mechanism. And the mechanism itself is meaningless. There's nothing unhealthy about a spike in insulin. God didn't give us insulin to cause diabetes. It's just how our bodies handle certain types of foods. No big deal. But that's the kind of insane environment we exist in now, where we no longer judge foods by what they actually do to our health. We just, look under a microscope and are horrified, when a certain hormone level gets high.
Yeah, I think there's definitely that problem when you start looking at all those mechanisms, whether it's your insulin spikes or if it's whether or not a food is alkaline or acidic, and I'm sure there are many more.
Yep. I mean, if you look too closely at any food, you can find something to scare you, including many vegetables. Well, the potato is a vegetable. So, that's another reason just to ignore, ignore it. Just keep it simple. Keep a big picture perspective.
Yeah. And this is a good transition to my next question, which I did read an article that you wrote, I think on your website, talking about all the different food groups and how there have been diets in our culture that unfairly demonize all of the food groups, whether that's dairy, carbohydrate, grains, and meat. But the one food group that hasn't been demonized yet is vegetables. And I think you wrote article that was demonizing vegetables and how vegetables are bad for you. Now, of course, this is a very tongue-in-cheek type of article, but it was just an example of how you can look at a food group too closely, and there are certain elements to that food group which you could unfairly come to the conclusion that it's bad for your health. Can you talk a little bit about how you can make the argument that vegetables are bad for us?
Yeah, so there are certain certain vegetables that contain nutrients that are pro-inflammatory, the nightshade category of vegetables, which includes eggplant, tomatoes, and a few others. If you have actually an inflammatory disease like rheumatoid arthritis, your doctor may tell you to avoid those vegetables or, you know, minimize your consumption of them. But, you know, if you want to put on, you know, sort of your diet cult glasses, what you can say is that most chronic diseases are inflammatory in nature. So why take the risk of consuming a category of vegetables that contains pro-inflammatory ingredients? You know, to be safe, just eliminate them. Well, you can go through that same logic with respect to all vegetables, so that really none of them are left standing. There are specific ingredients in various categories of vegetables that you can find a reason to avoid. But again, of course, if you just, you know, forget all of that microscopic stuff and look at the long-term health effects of eating vegetables in general, those effects are all positive.
Well, I don't know. Those phytochemicals are quite dangerous. I hear that they're a defense mechanism in plants.
Right. Yeah, that's another one. So you have most of these are actually just, there's so many they're unclassified, but it is apparent that many of the phytochemicals in vegetables that and fruits as well that function as antioxidants in our body are actually natural pesticides that plants evolve to protect themselves, so that they're actually toxins. But there's this effect called hormesis. It's Nietzsche's principle of whatever doesn't kill us makes us stronger. So you consume a vegetable that contains these toxins, and they provoke a stress response. So the reason they're good for you is actually they threaten your body, and your body responds in a way that enhances its own built-in antioxidant defenses. Exercise happens to work through hormesis as well. You know, we're familiar with the idea that exercise is a stressor. It actually, if you work out, if you're out of shape and you work out, you're actually threatening your body, you're threatening your health, but your body will respond to that challenge in a way that enhances your fitness. So that's hormesis as well.
Maybe your next book can be Exercise Cults. You can talk about how there are all these exercise groups that demonize one another, whether it's endurance training or CrossFit or one of the others.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, Jason. in the fall, I have a book called 80-20 Running coming out, and it's really a defense of tried and true practices in training for distance runners, and it's really meant to combat some of the clowns who are advocating, you know, basically training like a bodybuilder for distance running, or you know, all high intensity, forget junk miles, these the CrossFit endurance types of stuff. The run less, run faster types of stuff. So, you know, that stuff really started to annoy me as much as the diet cults did. And I felt that someone should stand up and just say the last word in the argument, you know, just stand up for the people. It's as if, you know, these people think that the best runners in the world have no idea what they're doing.
Maybe they're the best runners in the world for a reason.
Right, exactly. So, yep, so that is my exercise cults.
All right, great. Well, that will be a whole other discussion,
yep.
But let's get back with diet cults. And let's end it here. I want to end with a simple challenge to our listeners. You know, based on everything you've learned from writing diet cults and everything that you've, you know, learned in your research and all that, if you have one piece of advice, of course, in addition to reading diet cults, that could help a runner improve their diet so they can improve their performance, what would that be?
This is going to sound self-serving, but I recommend that you use my diet quality score tool. You can find it on racingweight.com. I introduced this tool in that book, Racing Weight. And it's just it's a simple way to gain perspective on how you're really eating, because most people, they look at their own diet through rose-colored glasses. Most people think they eat healthier than they do. You know, if you're only going to do one thing, make one change to your diet to improve your health and performance, you should simply increase its overall quality. And so that just amounts to eating more of the highest quality food types like fruits and vegetables and less of the lowest quality food types like fried foods and ice cream. But like anything else, it's easier to make progress if you actually quantify what you're doing. This is why we keep training logs. So using the diet quality score tool is kind of the nutritional or dietary equivalent of keeping a training log. It's a lot easier than counting calories, but it just gives you self-awareness on how much you need to improve and the specific ways you can improve. It's not something you have to do for the rest of your life. You just get into the habit until you've bootstrapped your way to a diet quality that is sufficient for you to achieve your goals, and then you can just maintain those habits for a lifetime.
I think I'm actually going to do a short challenge and do my own, take a case study on myself and look at my own diet. Because I know I fall into the trap of saying, oh, I run a lot, so therefore I can take a lot of liberties with my diet. And I think a lot of runners tend to do that. You know, we finish a hard workout and we say, oh, I deserve, my wife makes fun of me because I'll eat like a sleeve of cookies. And I can't believe I'm saying that. But, you know, it happens after a long run, and you know, I'm fortunate that I don't put on weight very easily. I'm very thin, but it would be very interesting to actually follow that diet scoring system and see how it turns out.
Yeah, I can almost guarantee that you won't regret it.
All right, and you know what? I think I'm gonna do that and publish it with this interview.
Awesome.
So let's do it. Okay, Matt. Hey, thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your book and all these topics today about diet for endurance athletes. I think we learned a lot, and I know listeners can learn even more by picking up your book if they are so inclined.
Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Take care, Matt.
Bye.